This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, Hillary Clinton has officially made history. The first woman Democratic presidential candidate formally accepted her party's nomination last night with a call for unity, particularly against Republican nominee Donald Trump.
Enough with the bigotry and the bombast. Donald Trump's not offering real change. He's offering empty promises. And what are we offering? A bold agenda to improve the lives of people across our country, to keep you safe, to get you good jobs, to give your kids the opportunities they deserve. The choice is clear, my friends.
After the speech, Donald Trump released a statement saying, quote, Hillary Clinton's speech was an insulting collection of cliches and recycled rhetoric. She spent the evening talking down to the American people that she's looked down on her whole life. We'll talk about that speech and some of the divisions in the Democratic Party.
And we have got to elect Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine.
Our weekend review panel will be talking about this and other things. Charlie Chippio is with us. He's senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us, Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, who just got back from the convention. Hello there, Anthony.
Hey, Deb. Good to be here.
So let's first get our takeaways from Hillary's speech last night. Anthony, you were there. What did you think?
Well, couple of things. I mean, it was very exciting to be in the hall. I mean, the delegates loved this speech. There was tremendous energy there. You know, what I thought about it was, I don't think it was a particularly great piece of oratory, but that's not Hillary Clinton's strength. And in a way, I don't think it was anyone was expecting her to deliver a great piece of oratory. But I think it did what it had to do. I mean, she seemed relaxed. She seemed comfortable delivering it. She seemed like she was having a good time, and she delivered a pretty good message about who she was, reintroducing herself to Americans, at the same time weaving in pretty effective attacks on Donald Trump. But I think what struck me about this speech was where it came in the week. I mean, in a way, it was a very effective capstone for to everything that had come before it. And the Democrats succeeded in sort of taking advantage of this opportunity that Republicans offered them. And that was to sort of respond to the negativism, the sort of grimness, the idea of America in decline, of Donald Trump saying, I'm the only one that can fix this. The Democrats were able to come back and sort of say, no, actually, it takes we the people, it takes all of us. And I thought Clinton was able to really wrap that theme up really effectively.
Shira Springer.
Yeah, I agree with Anthony. I think it was, as has been described, a very workmanlike speech given by Hillary Clinton. But one thing that stuck out to me was the fact that as she was cataloging her history in public service, going back to her work in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, that she laid, you know, her history has so often been used against her. You know, she's this establishment figure. She's been in Washington forever, and she has this long track record, and, you know, it's always contrasted with Trump the outsider. But what you saw was a woman who has been sincerely, or at least it seems sincerely, committed to certain issues over the long haul, in contrast to Trump, whose campaign can seem like it was done on a whim. So I like that aspect of it, showing the breadth of her portfolio.
Right. And Charlie Chippia.
Well, I think Donald Trump has been committed to himself exclusively for a very long time.
There is no public in Donald Trump's
right.
service.
That's right.
It's only to ego.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, I think we certainly know more about Bill and Hillary's relationship than we ever had thought about before.
And maybe more than we wanted to know.
That's true. That could be after this week. But yeah, I mean, I'd hate to agree, but I think that's true. I kind of had the sense that more than at any time when I'd seen her before, Hillary Clinton is sort of now comfortable with who she is and is no longer trying to necessarily be the warmest, try to be like her husband in that way, or to be the world's greatest orator. You know, she has many strengths. She's not those things. And I think that I just had a sense that she was sort of more comfortable in her own skin than I'd seen
before. Thought she made a very good point at one juncture of the piece when she said, you know, I've always been committed to public service.
The public.
I'm not so comfortable with the service I am.
Right.
And that's such a, you know, spot on for her.
There was one moment, there was a moment, though, that I thought she fell short a little bit. At one point, she said, I get it that some people just don't know what to make of me. And I sort of listened to that and I thought, I'm not sure that's the issue. I mean, but I'm not sure that she could address the real challenge. I mean, if you look at these public surveys, the issue that she has to contend with is that a lot of people don't trust her.
Yeah, it's an authenticity issue, which is hard for your own self to address.
Yeah, it's an authenticity issue, but it is, you know, it's related to the email scandals and to a whole bunch of things for a variety of reasons. And maybe some of the reasons aren't even founded on anything that makes a whole lot of sense. But, you know, public survey after public survey shows that a lot of folks just don't trust her. I'm not sure how she could have addressed that,
right.
But she didn't really do that. And I think to sort of say some people just don't know what to make of me wasn't quite, you know, quite the challenge that she faces.
We do have a clip of her describing some of her background where I think, obviously I wasn't in the strategy room here, but it does sound like this was an attempt for Clinton to be a little bit more personal, to say this is Hillary the woman. And this is where she told the story about her mother, who was abandoned by her parents at the age of 14, went to work as a housekeeper. And then Clinton went on and talked about how that inspired her, especially her early work right here in Massachusetts, in New Bedford, where she was working to create educational access for children with disabilities. Let's listen.
I remember meeting a young girl in a wheelchair on the small back porch of her house. She told me how badly she wanted to go to school. It just didn't seem possible in those days. And I couldn't stop thinking of my mother and what she'd gone through as a child. It became clear to me that simply caring is not enough. To drive real progress, you have to change both hearts and laws. You need both understanding and action.
So I'm wondering, Anthony, let's start with you. Did she make any headway there at all? And you know, it was a historic moment, an emotional moment. The cameras, anyway, were panning the crowd. You saw women crying. This is the first woman nominee. No emotion from her. Could she have shown emotion and not have been criticized for showing emotion in that moment?
Well, I don't know. I tend to disagree. I mean, I know what you mean. I know that she doesn't get sort of really soft and fuzzy in a way. But I think she did show emotion. I mean, I saw if part of emotion is looking relaxed, is looking a little bit authentic, is actually looking like you're believing the words that you're delivering. And I thought she did manage to do that in that speech last night. She actually, I mean, I agree with what Charlie said. She actually looked comfortable within her own skin, and with the idea that, look, you're not going to get sort of great oratory from me. This is who I am. I'm comfortable with policy. I'm a policy wonk. And that's what she did.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, the conventional wisdom is, I think there's some truth to it, that really the one time she did show emotion really worked to her benefit prior to the New Hampshire primary in 2008.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I think if you're Hillary Clinton, you run the risk of showing inauthentic emotion or your emotion coming across as inauthentic. So if you're not feeling it, you know, when Michelle Obama gave her speech, there was a point where she became choked up when she was talking about the White House being built by slaves. And it was authentic and it was real and it was palpable. And I think if you're Hillary Clinton and you're not feeling it in the same way, you shouldn't try to act it, because that only compounds the authenticity issue for
you. I want to sort of relate a point of view that I heard from, I just love this comment. I spoke to the head of the Alaskan delegation, and her name was Casey Steino. And Casey said, you know, everyone wants to see Hillary Clinton be soft and fuzzy, but you know, you don't hear that being asked of Donald Trump.
Yeah,
she
true.
Said,
yeah.
She said, you know, Hillary Clinton is in charge. You know, she gets things done. And you just wouldn't sort of be demanding of male candidates that, you know, we want to see the soft and fuzzy side of her.
Right. That being said, I think it was very effective. Her surrogates very effectively showed emotion. I mean, you can cite Michelle Obama, but the example that really comes to mind is, was it Khizr Khan who spoke last night?
Right.
The Muslim father of a soldier that died fighting for the United States, and he pulls out the Constitution and he says, you know, here, Trump, you can have my copy if you've never read it. But more importantly, he said, you know, directed to Donald Trump, that you have sacrificed nothing and no one. And that kind of emotion is far better and I think does far more for Hillary and Hillary's case than Hillary could have.
Even more powerful because it was expressed in such a dignified way. It was amazing.
Well, let's talk about the Trump bashing here because it was everywhere throughout the convention. And, of course, Hillary did it also during her speech last night. And we have a clip. And I want to talk about whether you think that this made any inroads, change people's minds, particularly Republicans who may be concerned about Trump, because it did seem as if those were the folks she may have been trying to reach in her speech last night. Let's listen.
Do you really think Donald Trump has the temperament to be commander in chief? Donald Trump can't even handle the rough and tumble of a presidential campaign. He loses his cool at the slightest provocation. When he's gotten a tough question from a reporter, when he's challenged in a debate, when he sees a protester at a rally. Imagine, if you dare, imagine him in the Oval Office facing a real crisis. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
So,
and Trump took the bait.
He
took the bait, and he, you know, started a Twitter storm immediately after this, criticizing Hillary. I mean, it was amazing. It was like she was daring him to show his sort of fiery side, his impulsive side, and he did it. And nobody on his team apparently could stop him or lock him in a room long enough to keep him from his phone.
Right. You know, over the years, we've had a couple of conversations with former Governor Michael Dukakis about this issue, and Dukakis always sort of takes the blame for his failed presidential campaign for not fighting back against George Bush. Mm. So, you know, his advice is you've got to answer these attacks. On the other hand, Clinton runs a risk that if she gets too down low and dirty, what happened to Donald Trump's Republican candidates during the primary?
Marco Rubio.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, his opponents during the primary could happen to her. So she has to walk that fine line. Of course, she has to hit back. And Donald Trump has his own attack machine, as we know, that goes on all day, every day. So she's got to hit back. But how she hits back is really, really important.
But I think the tweet hit. I mean, I don't know if you would agree, but I think the tweet line, the baiting, you know, baiting him with the tweet line was the perfect way to hit back. But now it's done. She should not come back at him about any of those tweets. It's done. Put it in a box. Move on with campaigning across Pennsylvania and Ohio today and keep going.
I also just have to say, as somebody who is not real positive about either major party, that I think it's fair. We have to point out that, yes, certainly they went after Trump as people at any convention would. There certainly was not anybody. There weren't any extended chance of lock her up. You know, I mean, it was nothing compared to what had happened the week before, which was pretty
really
amazing.
Right. And some of the more memorable speeches actually were overwhelmingly positive. I mean, if you think about Michelle Obama's speech, you know, that really stole the show in that first night. That was, I mean, she even made the point, you know, when they go low, we go high. Mm-hmm. You know, Bill Clinton's speech didn't say word one that was negative. Of course, it was focused all on his wife. I mean, there was a lot of positive energy that came out of that. I mean, and this has been talked about. I mean, this is one of the big contrasts between Cleveland and Philadelphia. It was just the optimism that was expressed in Philadelphia.
Well, I think you have more people who want to vote for Hillary if they're feeling optimistic, and then conversely, more if they're feeling negative about the state of the country, turn toward Trump.
But I got a sense that it was conscious strategy
yes.
to portray optimism, and it was almost repetitive at times. Yes? I mean, did anyone think that?
Well, these conventions are...
I thought the whole thing was repetitive, but it was sort of building and building these themes over and over again. That's sort of the nature of conventions.
I mean, they're so choreographed. They've just gotten so incredibly choreographed. That's just sort of a given. What I did think was clever that, you know, given that it's a testament to how the Republicans have kind of run out of ideas that they're still talking about Reagan. And it's the only thing that they can agree with. But I thought the whole idea of comparing the morning in America and Reagan's view and his, you know, his campaigns and his ads to the Midnight in America, and just how bleak that whole vision has become over 30 years.
I mean, that really, Charlie, I mean, that is what is really interesting about this, because, you know, I talked about the Republicans handing the Democrats an opportunity, and this idea of being so positive about America, this is what put Ronald Reagan on the path to success.
Yeah. Isn't that the odd thing, though?
And
about
it seems like the Democrats have completely, you know, they've been able to wrap themselves in the flag in Philadelphia and talk about we the people and sort of what makes America great, and it's this great spirit of optimism. These were all once upon a time Republican ideas.
Well, I was going to say that was the sort of the through the looking glass aspect of the Democratic convention, which was you had a whole bunch of Republican commentators afterwards saying how much the Democratic convention reminded them of a Ronald Reagan convention. Yeah. It was like a strange through the looking glass moment.
I'm ashamed to say that I actually caught myself when the Democrats started chanting USA and all this kind of stuff. And I found myself thinking, they're not supposed to do that. You know, it's like it was such an odd year.
Another thing that Hillary Clinton also had to do, has to still do, and had to do during this convention was try to win over the Bernie Sanders supporters. That was a big thing for her. There were folks who were not happy. So first I want you to listen to something that she had said about working not only on the issues that Sanders is passionate about, but also working with Bernie Sanders on those issues. This is from her speech last night.
Bernie Sanders and I will work together to make college tuition free for the middle class and debt free for all.
So that was Hillary during the speech. But a couple of times when she mentioned Bernie Sanders and the cameras would go to Bernie Sanders, he looked as if he wanted to be anywhere else but sitting in those seats. Anthony, I'm wondering, what was it like from there and certainly the mood among Sanders supporters?
Well, I mean, it really depends who you talk to. I mean, I think the vast majority of Sanders supporters came around or were already there. But by the end of the week, certainly came around to the idea that they've got to unite with the rest of the Democrats to beat Donald Trump. There was a hardcore group of Bernie supporters who wouldn't give up. And, you know, we saw them in the media room. They came over. They occupied it. They had tape over their mouths. Some of them actually gave interviews with tape over their mouths. But you actually heard this group during Hillary Clinton's speech. And this doesn't come through on the TV coverage, I understand. But Clinton delivered that speech with a constant chorus of heckling in the background. I mean, it was intermittent, but it kept coming back and coming back and coming back, and it was really something. So, Deb, there was a sort of hardcore, determined opposition among Bernie supporters to Hillary Clinton. But I think by the end of the week, it represented a very small minority of the delegation.
Actually curious about that, because watching it on TV, it seemed a much more united convention by Thursday night than it was on Monday night.
There's no question that it was.
Seemed that way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt like it was during the roll call where you just felt this wave of sort of positive pro-Hillary emotion just sweep across that auditorium. I mean, there were still people booing. There were still people upset that Sanders was going to lose, but they kept being drowned out by the huge ovation in favor of Hillary Clinton. And then when Bernie Sanders, you know, moved to suspend the rules and have everybody vote to nominate Hillary by acclamation, you know, that sort of sealed the deal.
Given, though, what you saw, you know, in terms of optics and what Deborah was mentioning about seeing sort of the sad Bernie during Hillary's speech, I mean, do you think it's realistic for the two of them to be together, work together on the campaign trail?
What I think is realistic is what Bernie Sanders said to all the different delegations. He went around to a lot of different delegations and said, look, we've got two stages of the campaign ahead of us. The first stage is we have to beat Donald Trump. And then the day after the election, the second phase is our revolution continues. You know, our effort to push the progressive cause continues. And I think he'll do it any way he can. I mean, one of the ways he wants to do it is to encourage more younger folks to move into office and up and down the ballot and local elections as well. But I think he'll work with Hillary Clinton if Hillary Clinton wants to work with him. I think the issue is she needs him more than he needs her. She really, really needs him, because in a close election, she's going to need all of those Bernie Sanders supporters. And polls show that, you know, depending on which polls you look at, you know, 10-20% of them don't want to vote for her. She needs those people.
It's very interesting because she really needs him until between now and November 8th. And then if she wins, you know, he's really going to need her to come come through for him.
You mentioned, though, the young people, which is another interesting optic, I thought, between the DNC and the RNC, which was when you saw those crowd shots around the Democratic National Convention, it was a young or much, much younger crowd than you saw with the Republicans. It was just amazing.
But let's
and hipper.
Let's just briefly talk about what we expect in the next 100 days or so. I mean, now the conventions are over. They've got their nominees. Is it going to get ugly?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Well, unanimous.
Immediately.
There we go.
Isn't it a bit ugly already, though?
But it could get uglier.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How?
Well, you have Donald Trump. I mean, I think those are the that's all you need to know. I mean, he knows no bounds on Twitter, in person. I mean, just, you know, going back to all the Russia comments. I mean, you name it. The man has no conscience, no bounds when it comes to campaigning. So anything is fair game. And he will get as dirty as he needs to be. You know, that's my personal belief.
And these will be the highest rated debates in the history of presidential debates.
Yeah,
I was going to say the big thing, the next big moment will be these debates.
Starting in September, right?
If they happen. Yeah. I mean, you know, I heard someone say out in Philadelphia, you know, if they happen, because one could imagine Donald Trump sort of figuring out a way, getting so sort of exercised about the format or upset about the moderators or feeling that he would be treated unfairly. But of course, my guess is they will happen, but they're going to be something
but
to watch.
Two out of three.
Yeah. But also, you know, let's be real about this. Donald Trump doesn't know anything about these issues. I don't know that I would want to, if I were him, be up there and be in a position where I were sort of more forced to actually have to talk about this.
And that was another thing that struck me about Hillary's speech last time. It was all about her competency. I mean, there was a lot of emphasis on her competency throughout her career. And that's, again, in juxtaposition to Donald Trump's lack of competency in all these areas.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's important to point out, I mean, there are tens of millions of people who are supporting Donald Trump and what he is managing to do to them. I mean, he may not, you know, have a firm grasp of the issue and facts and policy. I get that. But what he's got a firm grip on is emotion. And that's emotion is a powerful thing. And emotion is what has propelled him to this point. And, you know, to have won more votes than any other Republican nominee in history. So I wouldn't discount that. I mean, I think, you know, going into a debate, you've got to give Hillary Clinton, obviously, the advantage. But because she has the advantage, she could be upended by this sort of raw emotion that he can tap into.
It reminds you of that classic story from Adlai Stevenson in 1956, where the woman goes up to him and says, "Oh, Governor Stevenson, all the thinking people are behind you." And he looks at her and says, "Yes, but I need to win a majority."
Well, I'm sure we will continue to talk about this as the election season goes on. But we have very short amount of time now to talk about our hubbubs. And those are the little stories that didn't get all that much attention this week. Shira, what's your hubbub?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to Eleonora Mendonca, who traveled from Boston to Rio de Janeiro, where she will be a runner in the Olympic torch relay. Mendonca grew up in Brazil. She came to the U.S. for graduate school, and she settled in Cambridge. She became a fan of the Boston Marathon, became a distance runner, ran in the 1984 L.A. Olympics, was one of the women who was key in getting the women's marathon into the Olympics. And as a result, the Brazilian Olympic Committee is honoring her with one of the last legs in the Olympic marathon. But she's a Boston native now.
All right.
A Boston resident
now. Right. Well, we will check in with you throughout the Olympics, Shira, as well. Charlie, do you have a hubbub this week?
Yes. Well, in honor of Shira going down to cover the Olympics, mine is also Olympic related, but it's a little bit different. I have to say, I read an article in the current issue of Esquire that I found absolutely astonishing that upon the arrival in the Olympic Village, there will be awaiting these athletes enough condoms for each of them to use 2.68 condoms per athlete per day. So I thought it's pretty astonishing that
these people are in shape.
I could never be. I could neither be an Olympic athlete nor compete with them
Tinder
on the other side as well.
TMI. Anthony, let's hear your hubbub.
All right. So this is a good combination of two things that I care a lot about. The Charles River and beer, which by the way, I need after 2 weeks the conventions.
Yes, but, you do.
So as part of a Hub Week competition, six local breweries are going to make beer using water from the Charles River.
Mm.
The beers are going to be tested and judged at an event in September. Now, I want to point out that last year, we were able to taste some Charles River brew. It was done by Harpoon Beer, and they used a system of purifying the water. And actually, the beer was pretty good.
You did a segment on it.
And you're still alive.
Yeah, we did a segment on it.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, that is it for this week. I want to thank all of you for being our Week in Review panel this week. Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter. Go get yourself a beer and a nap after all that work. Thanks so much.
I will do that. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.